I often think of Thanksgiving as the most important Buddhist holiday, because we could say the heart of our practice is gratitude, giving thanks for what is, and opening our gratitude to include more and more, so maybe eventually we can be grateful for everything that's happening. Give thanks. And one way to practice gratitude for our life in this world is the practice of the Bodhisattva precepts. And one way of practicing devotion to both all the Buddhas and devotion to all sentient beings at the same time is the practice of the Bodhisattva precepts. It's devotion to Buddhas because it's aligning ourselves with all the Buddhas who are born from these precepts, and it's devotion to all sentient beings because these are the precepts that protect and benefit sentient beings. And we now live in this post-election country and world with maybe a heightened awareness of racism, sexism, classism, speciesism, neglect of the poor, the climate crisis, destruction of the environment, and fear and worry. All these things have always been with us, but it seems they're brought to the forefront more than ever these days. So there's many ways we could talk about responding to the situation of our present circumstances in our country and world. But again, I propose that the practice of the Bodhisattva precepts is the complete response to all of these issues. From beginningless time, the Buddhas have been born from these precepts and live this way as an example to others, both to benefit others and an example. And we might sometimes feel like, well, no one's really paying attention to what we're doing anyway, so we're not really an example. But in fact, I think that everybody, it's life, just by the very fact that we're alive in a world with other people, our life is an example, whether we like it or not. Sometimes we might wish that nobody would notice. But I think it's unavoidable. Even if we were a hermit living alone in the deep mountain forests without anyone knowing what we were up to, still our life is an example. I think it's inescapable. So therefore, we're all influencing each other. In fact, that's all we are. We might even say our present life is just the culmination of all the influences of other people that have been experienced by us. That's kind of one way of looking at interdependence of all people and all beings, is is just inconceivable mutual influence. So each one of us can be this light as an example for others. I recently came across a saying attributed to our Zen ancestor Bodhidharma, who said, "One whose conduct and understanding are in accord is called a Zen ancestor." Very simple statement, but also very profound and very hard to live up to, I think. Both parts. Our conduct might be quite good, but our understanding may be not so clear, and so they're not quite in accord. Or our understanding may be quite clear, but our conduct's not quite in accord with it. And so when both are indivisibly harmonious, our conduct and understanding, this is the practice of the Bodhisattva precepts. This is the Buddha's mind and heart. And it's hard. It's no easy matter. But it's a practice we maybe all have heard about before, these precepts. If not, I'll go through them. But I think it really is a way to live in this complicated life. We wonder, how do we respond? And usually these precepts are worded as sort of negatives, what we're not doing. But that's a big piece, because most of these problems are caused by doing that kind of is not in accord with these precepts. So the Bodhisattva precepts, we're teaching a class on these precepts, these months of this practice period, so it's been on my mind a lot. And our Bodhisattva precepts, our 10 major precepts of our Zen tradition, come from the Brahmajala Sutra, the Brahmanet Mahayana Sutra. Brahma is like the in India is kind of like the Lord of the Gods, kind of like in a way ruling the universe in a certain sense, or overseeing the universe. And these kind of pre-Buddhist gods are still acknowledged by the Buddha, and the Buddha talks with them and hangs out with them sometimes. So this image of Brahma's net is like an inconceivable, boundless web of interconnectedness. So in this Brahma Net Sutra, the sutra says, "Shakyamuni Buddha contemplated the wonderful jewel net hung in Lord Brahma's palace," which is the whole universe, "and taught the Brahma Net Sutra for the great assembly." The Buddha said, "The innumerable worlds in the cosmos are like the eyes of the net," like a fishing net, right? It's the holes are like the eyes in the net, or maybe the knots are the eyes. I think it doesn't matter. It's the all the pieces of the net are like the innumerable worlds in the cosmos. Each and every world is different. Its variety infinite. So too are all the Dharma gates taught by the Buddhas. So the Buddha's appropriate response, ways to practice appropriate to each world and each situation. So it's an image of vast interdependence and non-separation, this jewel net. And the Buddha goes on to say that these radiant, diamond-like jewel precepts are the original source of all Buddhas and all Bodhisattvas, the seed or heart of Buddha nature. So I think that's an unusual statement, because we might think, well, first there's Buddhas, and then how do the Buddhas live? Their conduct is practicing and living in accord with these Buddha precepts or Bodhisattva precepts. But this sutra says that these radiant jewel precepts are the original source of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's not so much that the precepts are born from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but the other way around. In other words, before there's any Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, there is the reality of not killing and not stealing and not misusing sexuality and so on, these precepts. They're universal truths, we might even say. And from those, or the reality of, say, not killing life, gives birth to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I think that's an interesting way to look at these precepts. They're like the mother of the Buddhas, which says something that it kind of implies here, that these are not just like rules of conduct or something like that. They're not just guidelines or rules of behavior. They're like descriptions of reality. They're descriptions of reality, and therefore the Buddhas are them, or the Buddhas are born from them. They're also called Buddha nature precepts. All living beings, the Buddha says, without exception, have Buddha nature. All with consciousness, form, and mind are encompassed by these Buddha nature precepts. So this is the flavor of the Mahayana, great vehicle precepts. And the sutra says, when living beings receive Buddha's precepts, they enter the rank of all Buddhas, the same rank as great awakening. Truly, these disciples are children of all the Buddhas. So when anybody takes up these precepts, it's like at that moment they are Buddhas. They are equal with the Buddhas and equal with great awakening. One might say, when they forget them again, then they've forgotten that they're Buddha. But it's like receiving the precepts and being the precepts is being awakening. And the Buddha goes on to say, this precept light shines forth from my mouth. This light is neither blue, yellow, red, white, or black. It's neither form nor mind. It's neither existent nor non-existent, neither cause nor effect. This precept light is precisely the original source of all Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, and all disciples of Buddha in the Great Assembly. The precept light comes forth from the Buddha's mouth, which seems to imply that sometimes maybe it takes the form of words and sounds, but it's actually these words are not about the existent or the non-existent. They're beyond all our conceptual grasp. It's precept light pouring forth, shining forth from the Buddha's mouth. And this precept light is the original source of all the Buddhas. Therefore, all the disciples of Buddha should receive and observe, read, recite, and study these precepts with utmost attention. So that's the beginning of this Brahmanet Sutra. So then, we might wonder, if these precepts are the source of all Buddhas, what are they, and how do we practice with them? So to kind of go through these 10 major precepts, particularly how we might apply them to this, I call it, post-election world of the present. So the first Bodhisattva precept is not killing life. And all of these precepts are, in their true form, they are descriptions of non-duality or non-separation. So, 10 different angles, 10 different views of non-duality, beautifully displayed in their variety. So non-duality, we usually, by non-duality, mean non-separation of self and others, or mind and objects, same thing. We think of our mind as a subject, a self, and others as objects external to mind or separate from ourself. So I think we say self and others is another way of saying mind and object. And of course it seems like there's a mind over here that's aware of objects out there called you all, me all and you all. But the Buddhas tell us that's not really how it is. It's a very convincing illusion. And it might be difficult to open to the actual non-duality of mind and object or self and other. But it might not be so difficult. We could say it's the, in a way, it's the most profound teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors. So we sometimes think, it seems too much to really realize that. I like the idea, I love the idea, but to actually taste that and trust it completely in our own life and experience might seem too much, and yet it's right here, right now. It's not like a special, it's not a special state of mind to realize this. But we could say it is a different perspective than we usually have, because we're very used to this perspective of I'm over here and you're over there and we're separate. We might be related. Of course we're related, and we have, we influence each other. We definitely influence each other, and that's pretty easy to see. But non-duality is quite a bit deeper than that. It's that we are one being, actually. We are one being, or as a Zen ancestor Huangbo says, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just this one mind, outside of which nothing exists. So without going too much into this, because I always find myself going into this. I feel like it is the most important thing, actually, but to also bring up these precepts, I think is, and the way that they are expressing this non-duality is a good topic, I think, for tonight. I'll just leave you with this one exploration that you can take up as you're listening tonight and forever, as you wish, to become just really, really intimate with our own direct experience each moment, without putting aside all preconceptions of how the world must be. It must be that I'm over here and you're over there. Going to our direct experience of our own awareness in the present, we can look for the place where our awareness meets the experiences of the world and people and objects. And I propose that we will not find a meeting place. If we could find a place where our awareness meets these objects, we would have found duality. That would be duality. And so, but we have to look very hard to see that we can, very carefully, not so much hard, but very carefully, and in a focused and meticulous way, over and over again, in a sustained kind of way, to look for this meeting place and not find it. And that not finding it, I think, is the greatest gift we can ever receive. But if we don't look, we just assume that I and you meet, which means we're separate. So that's a kind of summary of non-duality. But these precepts point to this. So the first one, not killing. The reality of not killing is that there's no life separate from us for us to kill. It's like we are one being, right? So it's not like I over here can kill you over there. That's, of course, the way it appears, especially that's the way it appears if we're killing, that the other is not us. And I think if we really can realize that we never meet the other, that we cannot kill the other. Almost like we literally cannot kill the other. As our ancestor Dogen says, life is not killed. So that's what, from this reality of this precept, you could say the Buddhas are born from the reality that life cannot be killed. And then they live from that understanding. Their conduct is in accord with the understanding, the conduct that actually they don't even appear to kill. So in our post-election world at the present, I think there is a lot of fear of killing. And I think killing, this first precept also means, you know, harming in general, physically, and, you know, the most extreme kinds of destructive harm. I think we could subsume under this precept of killing, not killing. And, so if we can realize our non-separation with others, then this precept is naturally maintained, and others are protected. And this isn't a passive thing either. It's like, I think, to not kill, we have to be really actually alert and ready to act and speak up to protect the lives of others. So one of our great Zen koans about this precept is, in old days in China, there's a Zen teacher, Nan Chuan. And one time the monks in the east side of the temple and the west side of the temple were arguing about a cat. And maybe they were saying that this cat needs affordable health care. And some were saying, no, it doesn't. We can't afford that. Or some were saying, this is a Muslim cat, so it can't live in this country. And some are saying, that's crazy. This is a country born of religious freedom. So the poor cat, right, is caught in the middle of this argument. And Nan Chuan, the Zen teacher, comes and picks up the cat in the middle of the argument and says, if all of you arguing monks can speak some word here, I won't kill this cat. Say something or this cat is going to be killed. And these monks had been like saying a lot right up to this point. They've been fully involved in their opinions about what's the right or wrong thing to do about this cat. But as soon as the teacher brought it to the forefront and said, this cat's life is in danger right now. It's about to die. I'm going to kill it if you don't say something. In his great compassion as a Zen teacher to encourage the assembly to practice not killing. I will kill this cat. This cat will be killed if you can't speak a word right now. And they couldn't. They couldn't say a word. They didn't know how to respond. And Nan Chuan cut the cat in two. So we could say that there is a cat. There are many cats being held before us right now, are there not? And the Eastern and Western halls are definitely arguing about them. And can we say something, anything, something appropriate? And then we don't know if what they could have said that would have stopped Nan Chuan from killing this cat. Maybe it would have been enough to say, Nan Chuan, teacher, compassionate teacher, please don't do it. And he would have said, okay, I won't. They couldn't even say that, right? So how do we respond spontaneously and freshly? Like, in a way, there's no time to hesitate, right? And cats are already dying all around us. So, we just have to be awake, alert, notice that there's a cat, notice that we're arguing, and vow to save the cat. And I think that's what Nan Chuan was trying to do, is point out the danger of the situation and kind of wake up the arguing monks. And he did actually stop them from arguing. But there's a step beyond that, we might say. There's just stopping arguing, just being present. That's good. But then we might, sometimes people think, well, Zen is just about that. It's just about stopping. But this Zen story asks for more than just stopping. It asks for like a response, an expression. So that's the first Bodhisattva precept, not killing life. Yes, Richard?
I can't help it.
No, you can't.
I can't. I can't help it. It's like, I think you bring up that precept, it's incumbent on you to say how we have to kill to eat. We make soup every Friday out of vegetables we've killed. And I don't think you can pass that precept without at least giving us some way to live with that.
Well, as I said in one of our precepts classes, that from the ultimate perspective of these precepts, like that life is not killed, we could say that it's impossible to break any precept from that widest ultimate perspective. From the very conventional precept of not killing, the conventional perspective of where we're actually working out the details in the world of duality of the 10,000 million billion sentient beings. From the conventional precept, it's impossible to keep the precept. Could you follow that? From the ultimate perspective, it's impossible to break the precept. From the conventional perspective, it's impossible to keep the precept. And that's true with all 10. And so given that, we might say, well then, what do we do with that, right? And I would say, we keep both perspectives in mind. We keep the ultimate perspective in mind because that's what's actually helping us to, helping our conduct accord with our understanding. And in the conventional realm where, say, beings have to be killed for us to live, then, this is very just conventional way of looking at it, but I would say we're just aiming in the direction of like with each of these 10 precepts of minimizing it as much as possible. And it's impossible to do it perfectly. But and we might say, well, how far out of our way do we go to minimize? And I think as bodhisattvas, we try to go as far as we can. And but everyone's maybe going to come up with a different end point of what's possible. Like Shakyamuni Buddha seemed pretty amazing. Like he just had this life that was the perfect demonstration of these precepts, it looks like. So it's almost like he maybe didn't break these precepts even conventionally. But we, you know, in our complex modern lives, we just aim in this direction, I think. And if we don't, because if we don't say that, if we just say it's impossible, so don't even try, then that's the problem with the world right now, right? So it's, we aim, and maybe we, as we continue to practice, we realize we can go further. I mean, I feel like that's the case in my life, that a place where I might have thought was impossible before, and it seems like, well, no, that's actually, we can practice like that, and then you can see if there's further beyond that. And we all have our own habits and emphases on what's most important too. And there, I think it's nice, we might say, well, I'm really working on this precept, so and that's because it's what I resonate with most, so these other ones I'm kind of ignoring. I think with these 10 precepts, it's nice that we look at the ones that we're not as interested in too. So we all help each other in that way. Yeah, thank you. So the second bodhisattva precept is not stealing or not taking what's not given. So similarly, if we are one mind, one Buddha mind, there's nothing outside of us. This mind does not meet external objects. Therefore, the very idea of stealing, taking something that's not ours, doesn't make any sense. It's literally impossible from that perspective, right? Everything is ours. Each person can say that. The entire world is ours already. So I would say if we could realize that ultimate view where actually the precept cannot be broken, if we could truly realize it, not just some intellectual excuse or something, but really realize non-duality, then the conventional precept of not, you know, literally not taking what's ours in a way that other people would understand that, that also is in accord. The conventional conduct is in accord with the ultimate meaning of non-separation. Do you see how that works? And I think that's truly the beauty of Zen precepts. I have never heard of this in any other Buddhist tradition. The Zen precepts emphasize this non-dual ultimate perspective. And then at first glance, it might seem like that's a dangerous teaching because that could undermine the conventional. But the beauty of it is if we really realize the ultimate, it completely takes care of the conventional. Because you might say, oh, I realize there's really nothing outside me. It's all mine. Therefore, I'll just take that. Well, wait a second. What do you mean you'll just take it? If you feel like you have to take it and it's you know, inappropriate, like somebody will be harmed by that, then what's that about, right? And I think we maybe don't really realize it. So the conventional and the ultimate, the two truths, are inseparable. Sometimes we say we don't want to fall into like Zen sickness, which would be like getting stuck in the ultimate. But I would nuance that a little bit and say, like, if we really realize the ultimate, truly ultimate, it's not Zen sickness. It's impossible to be stuck in an ultimate that doesn't include the conventional or is, in a way, they're always, the true ultimate is the nature of the conventional. So So I think when we say stuck in the ultimate, we mean stuck in a false understanding of the ultimate, actually. It's not really the ultimate. We can't really get stuck in the ultimate. We're already in the ultimate. And truly understanding the ultimate non-duality has a built-in fail-safe. Its conduct will always be beneficial and harmless, I propose, from understanding. If we say, well, it looks like that person really understood the ultimate, but they're messing up in the conventional, let's say, I don't think it was really understanding, is what I would say. So, not taking what's not given, we could say in this modern world, I think a big way that we're taking what's not given is from the earth. Yeah, is we're kind of destroying the planet. And I think a lot of people would say, well, the planet is giving it to us. It is given. That's, I think, been our dominant worldview for many centuries, particularly in the Western European world, and based on various, actually, philosophical and religious views sometimes. The world is here for humans, but I think we're learning that this doesn't work. It's not given. And we see at the Standing Rock Dakota Pipeline protest where our Sangha member Liz is bearing witness right now that there's land that's not really given, that's being taken. There's water that supplies life, that gives life to humans and others, that's proposed to be taken. And then there's this oil, the blood of the earth, being sucked out for us. So again, this is just like Richard's question of, well, we need to take life to survive. We can try to minimize. I think same thing with this. I can't help thinking every time I hear about this pipeline, I feel like, well, people just don't build it on this native reservation. Build it over there. Let's all support building it over there. But I think most protesters are saying, no, let's not build it at all. But in fact, we are demanding our oil. We want oil. So I think, and we might say, we just don't want the oil from that pipeline. But this is on a bigger scale, I think it's like, it's sometimes we might be fooling ourselves a little bit because we want it both ways. No more oil. And we could say, we might say, logically speaking, we want clear energy, clean energy, and we want inexpensive cars that don't run on fossil fuels. And we are totally behind that. But in fact, that's not the case. It's not possible right now. So what can we do? And again, I would say, like, it's impossible to do this perfectly. If we want to heat buildings and drive, or go places in transportation. But how can we minimize it? And I feel like some might say that's kind of wimping out on the Bodhisattva precepts. It should be perfect. But I think it's impossible to be perfect. But can we keep going further and further in this direction? And also I think with all these things, like killing and taking oil from the earth, it's like we might feel like, well, just little me, being vegan or not turning on the heat or something like this. It's just the tiniest drop. It's not even a drop in the bucket. It's just no one's gonna follow these ways. But that's why I feel like this. The Bodhisattva is just setting the example, and it might be like fruitless. It might be like no one does notice. But in fact, we don't know how it's noticed. We don't know the extent of our example. So we just try. That's the bodhisattva spirit, I think. We just head in that direction. So the third bodhisattva precept is not misusing sexuality. And again, in our post-election world, there's a lot of strong feeling coming out about misogyny and misusing sexuality in this way, right? Sexism is being brought even more to the foreground in recent weeks. So, not misusing sexuality in this particular situation maybe just partly involve just being very aware of just kind of unconscious sexist beliefs. Just being as aware as we can of like when these are going on. I think sexism and racism are often like unconscious. So the more we can just notice and listen to the cries of the world, which we're hearing these days in the news, and is a kind of, I think, an aspect of not misusing sexuality. The fourth bodhisattva precept is not lying or speaking falsely. Again, I feel like the last months in the around the political elections, it almost seems like in order to be a politician, it's almost like you have to almost lie or at least greatly stretch the truth in order to get elected. It often seems, and you like, in other words, make promises that will be impossible to fulfill. It seems to be almost like the normal thing. And maybe we could say that's a skillful means that's necessary in the modern culture of how elections work. Because hopefully you want to get elected to bring benefit to beings. Hopefully that's the only reason people would want to be elected. We might doubt that that is the case, but even if that is the purely selfless reason to get elected, still, maybe a bodhisattva might stretch the truth as a skillful means just to get elected to benefit beings. They might try to promise something that they hope would be the case, but they might not be able to fulfill. So again, I think if we get perfectionistic about the literal meaning, maybe impossible. But in this world where the media too is just like, maybe lying is too strong a word, but there's so much differing opinions about facts. For example, in the news, and it all depends on which channel you watch or hear, right? It's so how can we, as we're being plummeted around by all these different opinions in the news, how can we try to remember this precept of not speaking falsely ourselves and not kind of just assume anything, really? And trying to understand all of these precepts, I think, is educating ourselves. Really all of them, I think, that's a big part of it. Before we actually do something, we try to learn more and more about how the world works, actually. Especially these days, it's much more complex a world than the Buddha's time in ancient India. But we also have these resources of knowledge, like the internet. Even though it can be biased, right, it's still an amazing source of information. We can find out how our you know, food choices affect the climate, for example, and different types of technologies of alternate energy sources, and how sexism is getting played out in society. I think research is actually part of, I think part of the Bodhisattva's vow. And I know, Thich Nhat Hanh has said, Bodhisattva's vow to, stay in touch with the news, what's going on, to stay open to the cries of the world. We might say it's Bodhisattvas in the past maybe would leave the world and try not to get distracted by all of these things, but we have to find our limit too. We can get, these days we can get so bombarded by the news and information that we lose our stability. But the Dalai Lama also watches or listens to the news every day as kind of part of his practice too, part of the Bodhisattva practice. Staying informed about how, particularly about how our actions affect the rest of the universe. It's so complicated, and the information is changing constantly too, and coming in again and again. So, not speaking falsely, not picking up on false information and assuming it's true, not assuming it's true and then spreading it out to others, but trying to, you know, check it out as best we can, and of course we'll fail. It's so complex. But speech has huge impacts on the world. Speech and writing, conveying information. Again, I think more than ever before in the history of the world, we live in a world of words and information. The internet is basically like an all-pervading web of words and speech. Some photos do. It's a lot about speech. So can we encourage true and beneficial speech? The fifth Bodhisattva precept is, we say, not intoxicating self or others, or sometimes selling the wine of delusion. And everything that we do, I would propose, every activity we do all day long is in order to alter our consciousness. It's maybe an unusual perspective. From having breakfast, to having a cup of coffee, to having a cup of tea, to watching the news, to listening to some music, to exercising, yoga. I'd say, really, these things are actually in order to alter our consciousness. And, but we might be able to see it this way, you know. Everything. Maybe not everything. Like we might say, washing the dishes is not, in order to alter our consciousness, it's just to clean the dishes. But we might say, well, actually, our consciousness feels more settled and relaxed when we have a clean kitchen. So we could even say washing the dishes is, it might be other things too, but it's partly to alter our consciousness. Definitely sitting zazen. Now some people might say true zazen is the one practice that's not about altering consciousness, because we're just being with what is and without altering anything. But in fact, that way of being with what is kind of alternate to how we usually are in the day. I think that's why we set it up as a particular time to come and settle into the present consciousness, which is different than our busy consciousness. So maybe zazen could be the one exception in the universe to not altering consciousness. But I think most people probably come to sit zazen to feel more settled and present and relaxed, which is called wanting to alter consciousness. So I say this because what's intoxication? If everything is in order to alter our consciousness, then there's nothing actually like wrong about that. I think that would be crazy. We couldn't live if we said that was, we should stop altering consciousness. That would, we'd have to die, I think. Which would be a kind of altering consciousness too. What's that?
Intoxication is poisoning.
Well, yeah, the literal meaning poisoning. So yeah, so we could say, altering consciousness in a way that is not beneficial to ourselves and others is poisoning. And you know, there might be lots of disagreement on what is toxic, what is poisoning, and what's not. But I think that's the, we put things into these categories, like these things are poisons and these are not poisons. Yeah, and it's kind of like we're maybe just, without, again, investigating deeply what seems beneficial and what seems harmful. And again, it's very complex. It's very hard to say. But I think that's what the Bodhisattva is always looking at. Since I'm constantly altering my consciousness, what are the best ways to do that? And the least toxic ways to do that. So, in the again, in this post-election world, I think one thing that seems kind of toxic, a toxic way to alter our consciousness, can sometimes be this kind of like too much media, too much like kind of angry expression of duality coming through the internet and many avenues. And I know Thich Nhat Hanh talks about media as potentially toxic. The same one who says Bodhisattvas vow to watch the news, right? Also says, be careful how we watch the news. Is it toxic or is it harmful or is it helpful? We might say, well, we have to hear some painful things in order to open to reality and be helpful. Yeah, painful is fine, but that's part of the Bodhisattva vow, is to open to pain. But when if it's something that's increasing, something that increases anger and the belief in the illusion of separation, I would say that's an intoxicant. And ways that we might alter our consciousness that open us to non-separation would be like a non-intoxicant. And, you know, everyone's got to find that for what that is for themselves. And maybe constantly it's changing too, as more information comes in. So the sixth Bodhisattva precept is not speaking of others' faults. This is one I think it's nice to just mention, that often we translate it as, sometimes in our precepts we translate it as slander, but slander in the dictionary means spreading false information about people. It's a kind of lying, as well as talking about people who aren't around. But slander means falsely. So the actual original precept here is a little more strict than that. It's like not speaking of others' faults, even when they're true. And also in this Brahmajala Sutra, it says not speaking of the faults of bodhisattvas. So it limits it to this category and says, well, maybe it's okay to speak of faults of non-bodhisattvas. I think it's particularly saying, for those who make this beneficial bodhisattva vow, even if they're constantly failing in this vow, it's so awesome that they have this vow to be of benefit. So let's give them the credit for at least making this vow to go in this direction and not speak of their faults, even though we're all constantly failing in our bodhisattva precepts. But not speaking of others' faults at all, we might say, wait a second, but actually there's things to point out in this world. that should be pointed out, that should be spoken of. And that's part of the Bodhisattva vow too. And again, I think with all of these precepts, the bottom line is always, I think two things. The bottom line is always, is it in accord with non-duality and non-separation, with the understanding and reality of the ultimate truth? And secondly, is it in accord with, like, as much as we can tell, not harming others or causing suffering and harm to others? That's the conventional part. And so, in a way, that's the one precept, the one double-sided precept, is be in accord with the reality of non-duality and don't harm others. And almost always those go together. Yeah. Should I say always they go together? Maybe we could say always, but if you can think of an exception, you can bring it up. So is it a benefit to bring up something that is being done that's causing harm? And in our precepts class, this a nice discussion came out of this about, can we critique actions rather than the person who does them? Yeah. So rather than, that's an evil person, and they always do such and such, so therefore they are at fault, or they are bad or wrong. Instead, it's more like this activity, this action that they're doing seems to be causing harm. And that may be okay to speak of faults in this way, where we remember their true nature. One commentary on the Brahmanet Sutra quotes the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra, which says, if you can find no goodness in sentient beings that's praiseworthy, you should recall their Buddha nature and praise that. Mm. That was a nice one. So no matter how harmful someone's being, if we can remember that they share this one mind, Buddha nature, with us, they are us, truly, on the most deepest level. And that manifestation of me, called this presidential candidate or something, is, also manifesting these kind of obscurations to this, the one Buddha nature that we share. So they're due to many causes and conditions over their whole lifetime. So they're making decisions that seem to be harmful. Can we see that whole conditioned mess and point out the way that it's not working so well, while still totally honoring their pristine and inconceivable shared true nature, their Buddha nature? I think it's pretty hard. But the more we recognize and open to our own Buddha nature, which is everybody's Buddha nature, the more we can actually, I think, start to open to it in others. We see that it must be. We easily forget, of course, but when we come to our senses, we can remember, oh yeah, they're exactly like me in this way. They are me in this way. And there's some big problems to address, too. Not speaking of others' faults. Oh, it's time. It's getting late. The last precepts, just to run through them. Not praising self and belittling others, obviously based on a total duality of inflating one and deflating the other. And not being possessive of dharma or wealth or anything. Not indulging in anger or harboring ill will. And not disparaging the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are are the manifestation of the radiant jewel-like bodhisattva precepts. So to disparage the Buddha Dharma and Sangha is to disparage the reality of non-duality. And then we're really sunk. Sorry, there's a lot to say about these precepts, right? We have one more class on them. And since it's late, maybe we can talk at tea if you'd like. But I offer this as a practice to live in this fearful, disturbing, and unreliable modern world where things are seem to be kind of falling apart in many ways. These bodhisattva precepts are indestructible, it is said. So no matter what happens, we can practice them to the end for the benefit of all beings. May the merit and positive energy we've gathered in our practice be offered throughout the universe to all suffering beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.